A group of Israeli settlers stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds ahead of a planned flag march that has drawn warnings from Palestinians. Iran calls on Turkey to respect Syria's sovereignty after Ankara threatens to launch a new offensive to create a so-called safe zone in the border area. Fierce fighting is reported in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces have intensified their attacks to capture more areas. Hello and welcome to World News, broadcast from our Tehran studios with me, Behruz Najafi. Now, beginning with Palestine, the city of Al-Quds is on edge. Dozens of Israeli settlers protected by forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound ahead of a controversial flag march. Settlers waved Israeli flags as they crossed the Damascus Gate and marched through Al-Quds' old city. They assaulted and beat up three Palestinians, causing them minor injuries. One of them was moved to the hospital for treatment. Several Palestinians were also arrested after Israeli forces attacked worshippers inside Al-Aqsa. Since early this morning, the Israeli military has restricted Palestinians' access to Al-Aqsa. Despite that, hundreds of worshippers have already gathered inside and outside the compound. The latest developments come as thousands of Israeli settlers are preparing to hold the controversial flag march. Now, that marks the anniversary of Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967. Different Palestinian groups, including Hamas, have warned of consequences if Israel fails to change the planned route and tries to approach Al-Aqsa. But Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett says that the march will proceed along the planned route. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Akandil tells us about the current security situation in Al-Quds.
Clashes took place inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque while Israeli forces firing heavy tear gas against the Palestinian protesters and the Palestinian worshippers. Palestinians had nothing inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque but stones to throw at the Israeli forces and the Israeli settlers in order to prevent the raid to continue taking place. The first raid to the Al-Aqsa Mosque started at 7 o'clock in the morning, local time. There would be another incursion to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex after almost 2 hours from now. This would be in preparation for the major march that is known as the Flag March, where thousands of Israeli settlers are expected to take part in this march under the protection of Israeli forces. The real challenge now is that the Palestinian resistance groups and the Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime not to allow the settlers to raid the mosque during the flag march and not to lift or raise the Israeli flag. And warned them also not to allow the Israeli settlers from touring inside the Muslim quarter of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the narrow streets of Al-Quds, this part where Palestinian Muslims live there. But the settlers have the green light to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and raise the Israeli flag during the flag march.
A high-ranking Israeli official has visited Saudi Arabia and met with senior Saudi officials, fueling speculation that the two sides could be taking reciprocal steps toward the normalization of the relations. But this is not a first contact of its kind. It's an open secret that Riyadh and Tel Aviv have had an unofficial behind-the-scenes relationship and have even coordinated security-related issues in the past.
A senior Israeli official has traveled to the Saudi capital and met inside the royal palace with a high-ranking Saudi official. According to Israel's Channel 12, the visit was meant to coordinate security cooperation between the two sides, which included the alleged common threats posed by Iran. The visit was linked to the two sides' mutual interest in leveling up their relations. In March, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said, "Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy, but looks to it as a potential ally," saying they have many interests that can pursue together. Riyadh and Tel Aviv have no formal diplomatic relations, although it is widely believed that they do have contacts behind the scenes. There are plenty of examples of this. In 2018, it was reported that the chief of staff of the Israeli army met his Saudi counterpart to discuss terrorism and the alleged threat from Iran. Saudi Arabia's decision to allow Air India flights to and from Tel Aviv to transit through Saudi airspace are tangible signs of a shift. When bin Salman was asked about Israel having a say on a stolen Palestinian land, he said he believes that the Jewish people have a right to a nation state in at least part of their ancestral homeland. U.S. President Joe Biden is going to travel to the occupied Palestinian territories. Biden administration officials are in talks with the Saudis about arranging a potential in-person meeting between Biden and the Saudi prince for the first time. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's advisor Eyal Hulata is expected to travel to the U.S. next week. Earlier this week, two senior U.S. officials reportedly visited Riyadh as the Biden administration is quietly mediating a Red Sea deal between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt that involves the transfer of two strategic islands, Tiran and Sanafir, in the Red Sea from Egyptian to Saudi sovereignty with Israeli consent. The deal could also pave the way for the official announcement of the normalization of ties between Riyadh and Tel Aviv. When asked about the report, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan refused to deny it, only saying more steps needed to be taken to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2020, Israel's then Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Riyadh and met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This year saw Washington brokering normalization of relations between the Israeli regime and some Arab states, including United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia's key Arab allies in the region. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause.
Saudi Arabia, like other Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf, has kept its relationship with Israel under wraps for quite some time. The monarchy has not recognized Israel since its occupation of Palestinian land in 1948. And traditionally, Riyadh's official policy toward the Middle East conflict has been supportive of Palestinian Arabs and against Israel. But just like any other Persian Gulf Arab state, Saudi Arabia has failed to take any actual steps that would promote the cause of Palestine.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have for years been conducting covert talks on diplomatic, security, and business affairs, and now Washington is trying to improve ties with Riyadh. U.S. officials are even seeking to organize a meeting between Biden and the Saudi crown prince. This comes against the backdrop of the global energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine. Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to rock the global energy market. The U.S. is finding itself increasingly reliant on Saudi Arabia, the world's largest crude oil exporter.
A Zionist entity like Israel, I can't really call them a country because they're not. Palestine is the legitimate country. Israel is usurped and stolen the land. So I would caution any nation. I look at what Israel has done to the United States, how they have infiltrated and use the Jewish population in the U.S. to influence our foreign policy in a manner that is no longer favorable to the American people, but instead is favorable to the government of Israel.
Saudi Arabia has refrained from normalizing ties with Israel, unlike Bahrain and UAE, saying it would not do so without a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But bin Salman calling Tel Aviv a potential ally could indicate that Riyadh has already betrayed the Palestinian cause, and admitting it overtly is only a matter of time.
In other news, Iran calling on Turkey to respect Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and that after Ankara announced plans for a new military operation in the Arab country. Foreign Ministry spokesman says Tehran is opposed to any recourse to military action and use of force to resolve disputes. According to Said Khatibzadeh, such measures violate the sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries and only complicate the situation. He said that Iran understands Turkey's security concerns, but the only way to address those concerns is via dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with neighbors. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan has threatened to launch a new military operation in Syria to create what he calls a safe zone in the border area. Well, I had a conversation with author and commentator John Stepling, and he blames the U.S. and NATO's provocations for unrest across the world, including on the Turkey-Syria border.
The Syrian situation, the incursions into Syria, are something that have happened over the last 6, 7, 8 years. I mean, it's been a source of unease and anger on the part of Erdogan and Turkey, and they do have some concerns with the stability or security in the south with the Kurds. But, you know, this is all, I mean, if you take all of this kind of incoherence and contradiction, you can lay it at the feet of U.S.-NATO provocation. I mean, that's really the problem here. These are the sources of global unrest right now in the most acute form is U.S. imperialist expansion in the form of NATO right to the borders of Russia, their open statement they want regime change in Moscow and so forth, just as they wanted regime change in Damascus. They've said they want Assad gone. This is the problem, is U.S., you know, American exceptionalism, this imperialist mindset that the U.S. can play the role of policeman to the planet and make the world safe for Western capital, Western business, and that's really the goal.
The Russian military is stepping up its campaign to take over the city of Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine. According to local officials, the city is under heavy shelling. No estimates available for the scale of damage or casualties from today's fighting. On Saturday, they said at least 2 people died and 13 buildings were destroyed. The Russian military says it's taking control of the nearby rail hub of Lyman and Donetsk, but according to Ukrainian officials, the city has not yet fallen. Moscow is pushing to seize the entire eastern regions of Donetsk and Lugansk, where it says it wants to protect the local pro-Russia population. It's also hitting areas farther away, including capital Kiev, with airstrikes. Okay, for an update on the latest on the ground there, let's go to Donetsk. Johnny Miller, our correspondent, is there and reporting things for us. Johnny, what's new?
Currently in the center of Donetsk. It's a lazy, warm Sunday afternoon here. And people are just walking around, strolling, playing with their families. The cafes are full. If you came to Donetsk not knowing there was a war on, you wouldn't believe that the front line is only 6 kilometers away, just on the outskirts of this city. When I first arrived here 2 weeks ago, you would hear the constant rumble and boom of outgoing and incoming artillery. But now, as you can hear, it's quite quiet. Although there is attacks during the night, one civilian was killed on the outskirts of town. The reason that it's much quieter here in the center of Donetsk at the moment is because of the Russian advances not far to the north of here, which are threatening the Ukrainian positions on the outskirts of town. President Zelensky says that it's hell and indescribably difficult for the Ukrainian forces in Donbass at the moment, which is in stark contrast to how placid it is here in Donetsk. This conflict is... While on one hand it's a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it's also a civil war and an ethno-cultural war. You ask most of the people around me here what they think of the separatists here in Donetsk and what they think of the Russian invasion. They'll tell you that they support the separatists and they support the Russian invasion. If you ask people in Kiev the same question, they will tell you that the separatists are wrong and that they do not support, and that's putting it mildly, the Russian invasion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Johnny, from what's going on the ground, what are we expecting to happen in the coming days? Further attacks or maybe some calm?
Well, Russia's making serious advances. It's very difficult for us to get close to it because the Russians don't allow many journalists close to the actual fighting. But the Russians are making serious advances. They plan to take the whole of Donbass. It's difficult to see just how Ukraine and NATO, their NATO backers, are going to be able to support them, give them enough weapons, heavy weapons in time for them to stop Russia taking the rest of Donbass. And then there's a hope that Russia may well call an end to its special military operation, or maybe they might try to take other cities like Kharkiv and Odessa. But increasingly, there are some calls for negotiations and peace. France and Germany have been trying to put pressure on the Ukrainians and Russia in order to seek negotiations. But at the moment, the Ukrainians are saying they will not negotiate unless there's a precondition that Russia will give back all their territory that they took at the beginning of this conflict. And Russia is simply not going to do that. But there are increasing calls for negotiations, but particularly Russia at the moment when it is on the advance, are not negotiate either.
Okay, thanks for that. Jana Miller, our correspondent in Donetsk, Ukraine. Now, meantime, Russia says that the West is absolutely wrong in trying to link a global surge in food prices to the Ukraine war and Moscow's blockade of Ukrainian ports. The foreign ministry spokeswoman says the prices for agricultural products surged in 2020 when the COVID pandemic caused major disruptions to supply chains. According to Maria Zakharova, the Western sanctions on Russia are, in her words, the main catalyst for the existing negative trends. She also accused the United States and the EU of diverting some 20 million tons of Ukrainian grain meant for Africa and West Asia to warehouses in Europe. Zakharova also said that the U.S. is provoking a food crisis in Ukraine by depleting its grain reserves through a wheat-for-weapons scheme. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
After 3 days of contradictory accounts of the police response to the attack that left 19 children and two teachers dead in a small South Texas city of Uvalde, it emerged that the decision by police to wait outside of the classroom where the 18-year-old gunman was barricaded appears to contravene U.S. federal and state guidelines developed over two decades that prioritize police disabling the gunman. We have prepared for you an article written by Edward Helmore. The piece is titled, Confront the Attacker. Texas police appear to have violated shooting response policy. New details on the apparent failure of local law enforcement to respond swiftly to the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, were raising questions on Saturday, 28th of May, about police procedures introduced after the 1999 Columbine shooting tragedy in Colorado. After 3 days of contradictory accounts of the police response to the attack in Uvalde that left 19 children and two teachers dead, it emerged that the decision by police to wait outside the classroom where the 18-year-old gunman was barricaded appears to contravene federal and state guidelines, developed over two decades, that prioritize police disabling the gunman. In Texas, Uvalde police officers received their latest training in recent months, with protocols advising that an officer's first priority is to move in and confront the attacker. According to policy, this may include bypassing the injured and not responding to cries for help from children. The chief of the area school's police department, separate from the city's police force, is Pedro Arredondo, who was incident commander during last Tuesday, 24th of May's shooting incident, and who has been described by authorities as having made the wrong decision by delaying the storming of the classroom until federal agents arrived. NBC News reported he completed the most recent training course in December on dealing with gun attacks and had been in post since 2020. It is not yet clear what exact situation Pedro Arredondo thought his police officers were confronting, and there are different response protocols for different variations on a shooting incident. Arredondo has not responded to media requests for comment. But unnamed law enforcement officials told the Associated Press on Saturday, 28th of May, that officers from other agencies had urged the school police chief to let them move in sooner. A source told the Associated Press news agency audio recordings from the scene capture officers from other agencies telling Arredondo that the gunman was still active and that the priority was to stop him. The Washington Post, citing a U.S. Customs and Border Protection official, said an off-duty Border Patrol tactical agent had arrived outside the classroom where the school police officers had been waiting an hour and basically said, "Let's get this done," before storming in and killing the gunman. The attacker was a local man, Salvador Ramos, who had recently turned 18, allowing him to buy weapons and ammunition legally. The official said of the federal agents who responded, "They have not told me they were frustrated," adding, "but they told me it was hard to discern who was in charge." The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, said on Friday, 27th of May, that he believed he had been misled about the initial response and promised an investigation into exactly who knew what, when, and who was in charge, and what they did. The governor added, "The bottom line would be, why did they not choose the strategy that would have been best to get in there and to eliminate the killer and to rescue the children?" Since the Columbine School massacre of 1999, many police departments have trained officers to go after an attacker as a matter of priority. After the shooting incident at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, in 2012, the FBI was given jurisdiction over mass shootings. That led to a series of FBI initiatives to train local law enforcement agencies in how to respond, including the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training, or ALERT program, which was developed in Texas. Agents are tasked with training law enforcement and other first responders to ensure that protocols for responding to active shooter situations are consistent across the country. According to the Department of Justice, the program has since trained more than 114,000 law enforcement first responders. The issue of local law enforcement came up after the 2018 Parkland, Florida mass shooting incident at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where a 19-year-old former pupil from the school killed 17 and wounded 17 others. The former Broward County Deputy Sheriff Scott Peterson, who had hidden while the gunman rampaged, was criminally charged with child neglect, resulting in great bodily harm, culpable negligence, and perjury. Florida prosecutors described Peterson's actions as unprecedented and irresponsible. Peterson is scheduled to go to trial in September and has denied the charges. The Washington Post reported the first police officers to arrive last Tuesday, 24th of May, were from the Uvalde City Police, which has some SWAT capability and about 40 officers. But command of the incident was taken by Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District Police Department, a separate division that has 6 police officers and oversees security for 8 local schools. According to Uvalde School District Police Facebook page, the small department hosted active shooter training at Uvalde High School in March. It read, "Our overall goal is to train every Uvalde area law enforcement officer so that we can prepare as best as possible for any situation that may arise." In 2019, the Texas legislature passed a measure requiring all school police officers undergo the training and noted the shift in law enforcement tactics since the Columbine tragedy and the failures of the Parkland response. The state curriculum advises an arriving officer's first priority is to move in and confront the attacker. The Texas curriculum states, "First responders to the active shooter scene will usually be required to place themselves in harm's way and display uncommon acts of courage to save the innocent." The 2020 state manual adds, "A first responder unwilling to place the lives of the innocent above their own safety should consider another career field."
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and here is some excellent food for thought from Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, the sixth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Beware of 3 categories of people: the traitor, the oppressor, and the talebearer. He who betrays others for your sake will surely betray you. He who oppresses others for your sake will surely oppress you. And he who bears others' news to you will surely bear your news to others.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the human dignity, and we said it is a parcel of the human being, if not the essence of the human being. And when that dignity is violated and taken, then obviously everything falls apart. And all these rights that we have revolves around and try to protect that human dignity. A human being, in the sight of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam, he sees this creature as a very dignified creature, and he has inner traits, like inner pure godly traits. And when I say godly traits, is because the Quran says, وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِي, and I have blown into him from my soul. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala obviously does not possess a soul, but he's trying to say he put something divine in the human being. And Amir al-Mu'mineen looks into the human being as that. And because of that, Amir al-Mu'mineen worked hard to try and to protect and maintain all the rights of the human being, be it the personal rights or social rights, such as the right to live, the right to safety, the right to equality, the right to education, the right to learning, the right to freedom. And all of these things were applied to its best at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen's government, when he was in power. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, did not just say these things by words, verbally, or he has written them, but in fact, he applied them. He was the embodiment of human rights himself. And he created the right environment to make sure that these laws are applied. And anyone, be it a Muslim or a non-Muslim, when they read the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, they can see that his main objective in life was to preserve the dignity of a human being in any way or shape possible. And he has suffered so much in trying to preserve that. And sometimes, not only was he trying to preserve the dignity and the rights of his friends or his family or his comrades or companions, but in fact, even his worst enemies, even those who he knew for sure will go fight him and ultimately will end up killing him. Even we know the story that he had with the guy that was going to kill him. The imam was nice and kind to him, and he saved his face value of that person. He did not look at him any different from others, even though he knew that this is the person that ultimately will kill him one day. Because Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he always looks at the beauty in the human being, the divine aspects of a human being. And he tried to glorify that to the best of his ability and do whatever it takes to try and to preserve it. And every time when Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, they tell him a story of something has happened to people, I mean, you know, calamities or problems has happened to people, he would be very upset about it. And even he himself, he used to sit by himself and says, maybe, perhaps there could be a person in Yemen or Sham that they never had or never tasted food or knew how it feels to be full. His main concern was trying to liberate and free mankind from slavery, from at least inner slavery before anything else. Now, let us take a short break and then we will continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he was trying to free human beings and save their dignity by providing them with the basic rights, education, freedom, safety, and so on and so forth. Based on that, based on the seerah of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the tradition and the ways of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ayatollah Sayyid al-Khumayni himself, the leader, the man who created a revolution in Iran and changed the course of history as we know it, he himself has used Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam as an example for himself to lead his people, to be specific, and make it an example for others to go by around the world and free them from the slavery that they are in. If we look at Iran before Imam Khomeini and the Shah government, you see that people lived in poverty. People had no education. People were, you know, segregated as classes, as a higher class and a lower class. Many people were given nothing. The wealth of the people itself was given to foreign countries. Actually, foreign countries were kind of taking everything from the people of Iran, and Iranians and the people of Iran were living in poverty as a result. When Imam Khomeini came, he wanted to do the same thing that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam did by trying to liberate people, by trying to free people. And that was the core of his move, which is to follow Amir al-Mu'mineen's step in trying to protect those humans. And if you look at the life of Imam Khomeini himself, he made it very clear that he himself has no gain, or he does not want any gain. He's not interested in becoming a leader. He's not interested in becoming a president or having a government. He's not interested in accumulating wealth. He's not interested in leading people in the sense that, you know, he wants to be over them. His entire move was trying to make sure, first, they are free, that no one can tell them what to do. No one can, you know, subject them to tyranny and to punishment for their beliefs and for their actions. No one can take the rights from them, at least to have the right to live, to have the right to educate themselves. They have the right to have safety, the right to use their own wealth for themselves, not to give it to someone else while they suffer. And he revolted. He made this huge revolution that, like I said, changed the course of history. So Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam was in the past, over 1400 years ago. Imam al-Khomeini, in the last 50 years, he done the exact same thing, where he said the human value, human dignity must be preserved by trying to make sure that we give it its right. We make sure that the rights that were taken from it, that was bringing this human being to a lower state, needs to be given back to them so they could live once again as humans and feel it, not to feel that they are slaves or living under fear because of someone else. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Chilean scientists believe they have found the world's oldest living tree in a lush green forest in the south of the country. The scientists say their study shows an ancient cypress known as the Great Grandfather might have been the record, beaten the record for the world's oldest tree by six centuries. The bristlecone pine tree in eastern California is the current record holder with over 4,800 years of age. The scientists who led the study says the sample they extracted and other dating methods suggest that the Chilean cypress with a 4 meter thick trunk is over 5,000 years old.
We could count all the rings, but we know it's not the tree's age. It's an estimation of what we call a minimum age. So for this kind of tree, the scientific challenge is to estimate with science the part that we do not see and that is missing. And that is what we did with the millennial Alersi. This method tells us that 80% of all possible growth trajectories give us an age of this living tree greater than 5,000 years. There's only a 20% chance that the tree is younger.
Borisovic is, however, concerned about visitors harming the tree, which is located in the Costero National Park. He says visitors are still able to circle the tree's base, step on its roots, and even take pieces of its bark. The tree is a conifer native to Chile and Argentina and can grow to heights of up to 45 meters.
The world's oldest living man has just turned 113 years and says he's going to be around at least 10 more years. Good for him. Born on May the 27th, 1909 in Venezuela, Juan Vicente Perez Mora is still in pink of his health and memory and does not take medication. He has no trouble recalling his childhood marriage and the names of his siblings, children and grandchildren. He has 41 grandchildren, by the way. So what is the secret behind a long life? Work hard, rest on holidays, go to bed early, love for God, and always carry him in your heart. The Guinness World Records declared Perez Mora the oldest living person last week. The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscience of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society was the organizer of this event. It said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Hebdenbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in Southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashanaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic birds from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 birds of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella birds, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the birds over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for birds and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bears' living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A glance around the globe shows that because of the state terrorism of the US, the world has been plunged into wars, bloodshed, genocide, occupation, economic recession, poverty, piracy, repression of masses by unrepresentative regimes, and even destruction of the natural environment. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, International Staff Writer. This article is published under the heading Time to Decisively Confront U.S. Crimes Against Humanity. Stay tuned for more. The world would indeed be a peaceful place if the criminal cliques that rule the United States of America, whether Democrat or Republican, were to abide by international law and cease terrorization of nations. This is nothing but wishful thinking. Washington, where thugs and rogues rule the roost, will never end its crimes against humanity unless the free world unites to decisively confront it. A glance around the globe shows that because of the state terrorism of the U.S., the world has been plunged into wars, bloodshed, genocide, occupation, economic recession, poverty, piracy, repression of masses by unrepresentative regimes, and even destruction of the natural environment. It is the United States of America which pushed Ukraine into an undesirable conflict in a bid to weaken, isolate, and blame Russia. It is the United States of America which holds not just most of the so-called Third World, but also industrialized Europe as hostage to its hegemony. It is the U.S. which has built a doomsday arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear, chemical, biological, etc., and has the unpardonable criminal record of dropping atomic bombs on Japan when the Second World War was virtually over, with Japanese imperialist troops on full retreat from all fronts. It is the U.S. which supports the illegal existence of Israel on Palestinian soil and its unabated genocide of the Palestinian people, in addition to using the Zionist entity as a base to terrorize the Muslim countries of West Asia and North Africa. It is the U.S. which, besides its unfair trade war against China, blatantly meddles in the breakaway island of Taiwan to try to undermine Beijing's rapidly increasing stature as a world power. It is the U.S. which has imposed a destructive war on Yemen through its clients, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. It is the U.S. which destroyed Afghanistan, destabilized Syria through the Takfiri terrorists, and continues to poke its dirty nose into the affairs of Iraq, as well as of Lebanon, in a bid to prevent national solidarity and formation of any broad-based government, even after elections. It is the U.S. which plunders the rich natural resources of Africa by exploiting dark-skinned people whose cousins, the Afro-Americans, are heavily discriminated against at home and subject to killing or imprisonment on the slightest pretext. It is the United States which is holding Latin America in thrall through its support of dictators and sanctions, or more properly, economic terrorism against independent countries like Cuba and Venezuela. It is the U.S. which is the biggest contributor to emission of dangerous gases into the atmosphere that have led to climate crises, deforestation, gradual extinction of many animal and bird species, pollution of the sea, and is tearing apart of the ozone protective layer of planet Earth. Last but not the least, the U.S. is the sworn enemy of Iran and the Iranian people because of their courage to confront the Yankees, in spite of the illegal sanctions of the past four decades and frequent acts of terrorism, including assassination of senior officials and acts of piracy on the high seas, the latest being the seizure of an oil tanker off the coast of Greece. All these crimes against humanity and numerous other acts of terrorism worldwide